This is Gray from Rebel Impact, and you're listening to I Rebel, a Star Wars Destiny podcast.
Forgery of Imperial documents, possession of stolen property, aggravated assault, resisting arrest.
On your own from the age of 15, reckless, aggressive, and undisciplined.
I rebel.
Welcome everyone to I Rebel. I am your host, Jedi Geek Girl. With me, I have a very special guest from the Rebellion as well, Rebel Gray.
I don't know that I'm like very special, but I'm just a guy who likes Star Wars Destiny. But thank you for having me.
You are a fellow Rebellion member, so you're always welcome here. So
yes, that is true. I am.
Before we start talking about Star Wars Destiny, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I'm a psychotherapist by day and a YouTube content creator by night, focusing on tactical discussions of the game and card analyses and, you know, trying to do something a little different than the usual, like just tabletop simulator gameplay and whatnot.
Before we dive into Legacy, which is on everybody's mind, I noticed that a lot of your content is geared towards beginners.
Yeah, I think in the beginning I did a lot of stuff towards beginners. I've tried to move the conversation a bit more towards intermediate players, which I kind of see as people who are trying to get into the competitive scene. And I've done a couple of advanced videos, but I feel like a lot of content creators are already covering that space. So I try to, fill in the sort of the lower levels here. And I don't mean that like in a negative way. Just, heck, we all started somewhere. And a lot of the questions that I'm answering on my show are questions that I would have really liked someone to answer for me, I guess.
That brings up the question. I noticed that a lot of what is out there isn't too helpful for beginners. Are you noticing that as well? Or is it just me, I guess?
Oh, no, definitely. Definitely. I think, you know, there's a lot of like words that we use in this culture of collectible card games. And some of that stuff is new and awkward and ever changing. And, I did a whole series on that because I felt like, well, people should probably know these things before they just step into a game store, because a lot of this stuff is like a foreign language to people, you know, things like card advantage and just, so all these terms that I've covered. No other content creators are really doing that. They're doing that from the perspective of players already know these words, let's move on. But I think a lot of players don't.
What do you think we could do as a community to help make the game more friendly for beginners? Because I know if you go on like Facebook or any other social forum and you ask a question as a beginner, you get ripped to shreds, basically.
Yeah. I try to, I'm trying to jump more into those conversations. I'm in a lot of the Facebook groups, and I didn't typically use Facebook for anything, but now that I do, just for Star Wars, I try to help out in that sense. And I think people just need to be more accepting, because the reality is competitive players are always like, well, this game is for me and I want this game to be for me. And I'm competitive too, and I know that you are, but we began somewhere, we came somewhere, and those players are the majority of players, those casual players or their intermediate level players, and they're really the ones that are paying the most amount of money to FFG to keep this game going. So I think competitive players sometimes need to take a step back and be like, not that we owe anything to those players, but just recognize that they're an integral part of the community just as much as we are.
I agree. I think that when it comes to the health of a game, you gotta respect and help your beginner levels, because they are the future of the game.
They're gonna be there's a player right now maybe starting who's gonna be at Worlds next year, who's gonna take top 16 or something like that, right? So, and that person, hopefully they're getting the respect that they deserve as a human being, and then as a player, also at their store.
Is that code for you talking about yourself?
Well, maybe. I don't plan on doing any traveling, and I don't see myself getting to that kind of competitive level. It's not really my thing. I used to be a really competitive fighting game player, and I don't do that anymore because it's very burnout level stuff for me.
Would you say that you take competition seriously?
I guess it depends on what day of the week you catch me on. I would say most of the time, yes, but I try to learn from my losses. I've always been a person who thinks that we learn more from our failures than our successes. And so I'd rather lose 100 games in a row and win one and be like, what did I learn from that that'll help me win the next 100 in a row? And I think, it's good to have a lighthearted look on things and not be so polarizing about your thoughts on competition.
I agree. That is something that I can learn. to handle a lot better because I can be really competitive. Diving into the game itself, what are you playing currently?
Right now, I've been working on trying to make Hero Mill decks work, and that has been kind of two flavors of deck, and I actually talked about something a little bit on a video I just made, but I'm doing like a Lando Mon Mothma deck, which didn't really work that well. Despite people trying to convince me that it's working, it's not working for me, and so working on a General Rican Jedi Instructor Padme Mill deck, which actually is seeing a lot more success than the other deck, and I feel like it might actually be competitive. I just hesitate to say things like that, like too publicly, because people are, then it's not, and people are like, "You're wrong, Gray. What are you talking about? You're crazy. What are you playing?"
I'm playing Mill as well. I am actually playing Unkar Thrawn, but I have not been able to play a lot. I've only been able to play in one tournament. However, I plan on playing in a tournament Monday and hopefully next Saturday. But I am excited. It is the deck to play. It has so many different ways to play. The way that I play right now is heavy control Mill, but obviously you can run vehicles, you can run Crime Lord. I just love the potential that you can run with the deck.
Absolutely, yeah. That deck is a beast. Like, those two characters together just make so many different things happen. It's crazy. It's like the social butterfly of decks right now. And I'm kind of jealous as a hero player, because Hero doesn't have like characters that are flex like that. They're all very like locked into like their solitary archetypes, and you don't see too many characters going across, you know, across the field too much. You know, maybe Rey a little bit. She's seen like some play in aggro or mid range, not mill or control, but maybe it's kind of discard side. And my Rey loves to roll discard, so maybe there's something there.
Outside of mill, what else do you play as a hero player? Besides Rey and Maz?
Well, technically I'm a red hero player. That's kind of where my first love is. I played a lot of Snap Baze. I played a lot of Leia Akbar. I like those kinds of decks. I think that they're challenging because red hero isn't this like, hey, I have all the tools that I need to win, like villain, yellow, or like red and villain, red and yellow villain. So I like the challenging decks that are a bit harder to navigate. I did play a lot of Poe Maz, but that was more like, hey, I know this deck can win. I can be competitive. But on casual nights, it's like, let me take out this janky launch bay deck and try to make something work. And just have fun, you know, because those are the days where you're supposed to have fun just playing in with people casually.
Have you picked up Poe Maz since Empire at War came out?
No, I haven't. I actually disassembled the deck after a multiplayer game. But I think the deck is a lot better. And I think people just kind of have it on the shelf a little bit. Kind of like how Rainbow Nines was kind of getting pushed away a little bit because of the new Kylo and things like that. I haven't picked up the deck, but I feel like there's more tools to it. There's a possibility that it can still keep 3 and 4 character lists out of the meta. People just haven't done it yet because, you know, they're playing with the new shiny toys. But once everything sort of settles, I think people will look back at it and say, oh yeah, we should throw Y-Wings in this deck. We should throw partnerships in this deck. We should throw C-3PO back in this deck consistently because there's something there that's really good still.
I wonder if people have figured out Poe Maz and that's why people are not playing it.
Maybe. I don't know. People get bored of stuff. Yeah, we had, what was it, 4 months of that? And maybe people just want to move on and try something different and new. And I certainly did. You know, I took it apart because I was like, I know I'm going to need these vehicles and these characters for other decks. And I don't want to just play the same old thing all the time because it gets tiring.
It does. I mean, I got to the point where I was waiting for new cards for about like 2 months. Like 2 months ago, I was like, I am ready for new cards. I am so used to a 3-month cycle for new sets from other CCGs that this 4-month gap is kind of like, it's almost like too long for me. But that's just because I'm used to 15 years of 3-month gap instead of 4.
Yeah, it's a big change. That extra month can be a lot, you know, especially if you play a lot of Destiny, right? If you're going to the store like 2-3 times a week, there's a level of burnout that you kind of have to think about and manage and say, maybe I don't go this week, you know, maybe I brew something new and come back next week and try that, you know, and fresh, keep the game fresh for yourself, because they can only print cards all at once in a big lump, and then you sift through them and make a deck and you try it, and then you don't like it, you put it away. But if you find something you like, it's almost the death of your fun, because then you're just playing that one deck all the time, or those one or two decks. You're not really trying anything else or anything new, you know, and I think that's the healthy part of why we have the card database websites that allow us to sort of make new decks, try new things. TTS is nice for that as well.
Speaking of which, how is attendance where you are locally? Is it healthy?
Yeah, it's actually really good. We had, for Empire at War, the Saturday after the release, we had a 36-person show-up for a sealed tournaments format. So things are pretty good. I'd say we get at least six for our quarterly kits. We've had, I think, as much as 12. Every other kind of weird format usually gets a good 12 to 16 players, something like that. It's usually 4 to 5 rounds of Swiss with a cut to at least top four for what we do. And it's good. Yeah, it's really healthy. But I also live in the New York City tri-state area, so we have a lot of groups in this area that all travel to sort of different stores and meet up with each other.
I can completely relate to that, especially being up here in Minnesota in the Twin Cities. We have like 20 events a week, I believe, roughly. I think it's more like 19, 18. But there are days where there are 3 events going on the same day. And while I think it is nice to have that many events going on, I cannot help but feel like it's kind of like spreading out the community, because you have 3 separate tournaments with maybe 6 people, 4 people, 6 people, instead of 1 with 16 people.
First of all, I'm trying to jealous of that. Let me tell you that, because I have to travel about an hour to get to my store one way, so it's a lot to do twice a week. But man, that'd be awesome. But I totally understand the concern, because you're right. Like, having 1 12-person tournament is better than having 2 6-person tournaments any day of the week, because you're going to see more decks. There's going to be an additional round, sometimes 2, depending on if you get more. And the competition is better when you centralize things like that. And I think that's why these big tournaments that we've had over the summer are very telling. And, you know, people should look at the people who won those things as like very good players, because they are very good players, because they didn't have to just beat 12 people or 20 people, which is still, you know, impressive. They had to beat 8, 9, 10 rounds of Swiss to get to where they are and then do a playoff. So, but man, I would love to have that many, that many events in my area.
Well, it is nice, but I don't always get to go to them because I'm always working or something like that. And then in the evening, I almost wish that everyone that ran the tournament would get together and try to coordinate so there is an overlap to try to maximize attendance and try to grow the community. Because if I am a new player and I'm like, okay, I want to go to this store on this day, and I go and there's like 4 or 6 people, it's kind of disheartening if I am looking for a healthier, more engaging experience. Where if there was an organized system to try to not having conflicting schedules, you might have a larger turnout.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say specifically like what the problems are sometimes. Like, I know before I started going to my store an hour away, there were 2 stores that were nearby in the area. And one, they both sold Star Wars Destiny, but one actually supported the game with tournaments and the quarterlies and stuff like that. And the other store more or less price gouged us on stuff. And so people were kind of, they were repelled by the idea that a retailer would try to do that. Although that's kind of that store's reputation. And it's not really a surprise, but sometimes you don't know what it is. You know, it's not necessarily that the players don't want to get together. It could be that stores are like, see themselves as rivals or something like that. And that stuff is all part of the formula that really prevents a community from being cohesive and combining and coming together to do really big tournaments like that. You know, sometimes it's up to a particular player in the meta to just say, hey guys, we're going to rent out this barn. It's got like 80 benches and we're just going to have a Star Wars Destiny tournament this weekend. You know, it's $15 buy-in. Here are the prizes. Let's go and do that. Cause maybe you need that, you know, maybe that would be good for, you know, I don't think the Minnesota meta has any problems from what I gather as far as getting competitive players. So you have FFG like in your backyard, don't you, essentially up there?
Yeah, we do. And I would argue that we have the most, and I'm throwing a gauntlet down here, but I would say that we have the best meta here. Although California, I think it probably has contention for that because Hyperloops are located out there. So
Right. Yeah. And Tiny Grimes and those guys out there. Yeah. They would definitely argue that their meta is probably stronger, but the Minnesota meta has come a long way, and they certainly have their players that are very good at this game. So,
I think it will probably take a couple of years for your regional meta to start getting refined to determine which one is the quote-unquote best. Because the game is still young, not everybody's on the same footing. I think California is still recovering from the lack of product from the first set and disinterest that way. The Minnesota meta, we have an unofficial ranking system and we have, like I said, 19 events a week, so it'll be really interesting to see what happens at Worlds.
I would love to see like the best players from those regions come together in a fight. You know, it'd be very much like a cross-country grudge match kind of thing. And that stuff, those kind of like stories, really like creates good feelings in the community because they're both competitive. And there's also a lot of camaraderie there because you love the same kind of game. And you get some bragging rights stuff going on, and I really like that element of competition. As long as people can keep it clean and respectful, that can be really awesome for the game.
You know what would be a really good idea is if the Destiny Council over here in Minnesota challenged Tiny Loops, and they had a playoff.
Yeah, that would be pretty awesome. Maybe you should suggest that to them. I'm sure that they're all on the Knights of Ren Discord, and they would be happy to exercise that kind of idea if they haven't already thought of it.
I do not speak for either one of them. I'm just saying it would be really interesting to see that because it would be nice to have a, like, yay, we are king of the Destiny meta, you know?
Yeah. Well, you got to plant the seed, right? You got to, like, get in with them and start being, hey, maybe you guys should challenge those other guys and maybe we'll get a fun together for some plane tickets and meet somewhere neutral, like, I don't know, Colorado or Wyoming someplace.
Or a Team Covenant.
Yeah, or a Team Covenant. Yeah.
It would definitely be interesting.
I would watch that stream all day.
Enough talking about what is going on right now. Let's talk about the future. How excited are you for Legacy?
I'm pretty excited about Legacy. Hey, new cards always get me excited, and they should get anyone else excited too, because the game means that the game is growing, the game is expanding, that the game will be around longer and longer. So these kinds of announcements they're super awesome. What did you think about some of the new cards that we saw?
I like the new elements that the set is bringing to the game. There is so much that I can talk about, like Dr. Aphra. I knew she was coming. I'm glad that she was coming. I'm a little disappointed that we got another Obi-Wan Luke, but I can understand what they're doing with it. It's just, there's so much potential with this upcoming set that I'm excited for the game and seeing where it goes.
Legacies, you know, is the starting point of Star Wars. Like, the characters that we're seeing are, hey, these are the guys that started it all, Episode 4, and this is what sort of they did with Awakenings a little bit, and then they're sort of going back to that and saying, hey, let's rewind it even further back and see where we can go with this. And I think it's super cool too. I really like the idea that they're doing here.
I am a bit more of a prequel fan, so while I am glad to see original trilogy characters, I love the focus of the prequel era and the expanded canon, so Obi-Wan is the best example of that.
Yeah, Obi-Wan looks awesome.
And he is so good. He is so good.
Oh yeah, his die is really good, but that 19 point cost is like, that is what old Obi-Wan and Luke needed to be. And now that we got it, we're going to get it. I think that's really great that they're thinking about that sort of stuff. And also just the fact that they think that die is worth 4 points. It's like, it tells you right away that they're starting to look at characters a little bit differently as well. You know, I think before they would, you know, they think that Jin's die is worth 5 points when it's not. So I think it's a change. You know, we're looking at some of the psychology behind the point stuff, and I think it's really good.
I wonder if his cost is 19 because of Rey.
Could be because of Rey. You know, maybe they're thinking about putting another 11 cost character in there. You know, obviously Maz is the first thing that comes to mind. You could do some crazy stuff with him and Maz.
The thing about Maz is so fragile. You know what I'm saying? When I play Poe Maz, it's not surprising that Maz dies turn one. If Maz had like maybe 9 health, it would be a little bit better. But I don't know if I would pair him with Maz even though I get access to 4 dice.
Yeah, I guess it depends on, like, you know, again, how many other cards are you going to need to make Obi-Wan's win condition work for you as aggro? He's got such a solid die with the 2/3s and the 3 for $1. He's in Blue Hero, so there's going to be some kind of resource problems there. But, you know, we've got a lot of cool stuff in Empire at War. You know, Reaping the Crystal, the Force is strong, allowing you to, like, you know, discard a card. That's originally from Awakenings, I think. But there's stuff. There's stuff going on to make Blue hero work. And there's stuff like Protective Mentor, even, that you could throw on him and let him block some shields, lose his shields to block some damage from Maz. Blastoid Armor, you know, how many spots are you going to have to keep Maz alive, and is it worth it at that point? But I just think the point cost in general is kind of interesting.
What I really like about Obi-Wan, the new Obi-Wan, is how it combos with cards that we already have, such as Riposte and... What is the one that does unblockable damage?
Synchronicity?
Synchronicity, yes. Obi-Wan and his lightsaber makes both of those things good.
And that lightsaber is insane. I mean, 3 cost for a die that has an expected value of over 2, that's crazy good. I mean, 2x plus 3x, 2 shields. Like, there is no other card in the game that has 2 shield sides, and certainly not one with the special that allows you to do what it does. And I think that is... super great. It's going to be super good in Qui-Gon, of course. They're really trying to drive home this Blue Hero Shield thing, it seems.
So here's the question. If you had to build a deck with Obi-Wan Kenobi's lightsaber as the backbone, which character would you put with it, Obi-Wan or Qui-Gon?
I think Qui-Gon is a better choice, just because it's so easy to keep him at max shields in most games. That one special being turned into 3 unblockable damage swing, not having to remove his shields, and then being able to riposte, is 6 damage in a turn, not including whatever he's going to do with his dice. You know, he could ping 2 more times. He could do up to 4 more melee damage, a combination of that. This lightsaber is actually made more for Qui-Gon than Obi-Wan by like a mile. That's my opinion.
I have to laugh when I see this card because, you know, Rick from Knights of Ren always wants Qui-Gon to work. And every time a new set comes out, he always looks at Qui-Gon. And when Legacies come out, I'm sure he's going to look at Qui-Gon yet again.
Qui-Gon's that quintessential hero character that every single expansion, hero characters, we circle back to him. Because we're like, okay, what new tools did we get to make this old deck work, right? And Qui-Gon is always there because he works so well with Rey and also now with Kanan. So he's got more options to him. And he really does a great job with the whole shield thing. And every time you put more cards that do stuff with shields, Qui-Gon's like, hey, I'm getting better and better. And it's almost like he's power creeping very, very slowly. Like, we're talking about a 4th set, and we're still talking about a character from the 1st set. That means he's a good character. He was well-made, well-costed, and people like him. Because he's my favorite character, by the way. I love Qui-Gon.
With what you're saying and... what he has done, I look at him and I think he is one of the most balanced characters in Destiny. For his point cost and his tools, it just seems like they really hit the nail on the head with this card when it comes to balance.
Totally. Yeah, and then you look at something like Luminara and you're like, wait, what happened? Same point cost, but not even close in terms of power level.
Well, not everybody can be good, you know?
That's true. Not everybody can be Qui-Gon.
Moving on to the new elements to this game, what do you think of the power action keyword?
Oh, I often wonder in these previews if they're trying to tell us something about what's closer than it actually, like objects in mirror appear closer than they are, and if this is what the errata to FN is going to be. You know, is it going to be power action errata? And they're just trying to introduce that idea now, so it doesn't seem too vague or unfamiliar when we do see it. I think it's good because there's a number of different characters that you can look at over the course of the game where you're like, I kind of wish I could only do this once, like Unkar. I kind of wish they could only Unkar me once per turn. It's a little unfair that they can continue to do that because he's not limited by anything. Rey, another example of a power action could be really useful to errata her. So I think this mechanic is good, and they're trying to slow down the action cheating a little bit. You know, they're applying some brakes, and I think that's what the game needs a bit. You know, they're trying to slow it down after Spirit of Rebellion, which this game was running at like 100 miles an hour with Spirit of Rebellion.
I agree. I think that the power action keyword comes to reaction to Rey more than FN due to the development cycle. I mean, this set was designed and developed when the Spirit of Rebellion meta was happening, and FN really didn't hit his peak until after the first errata. So if I had to say this is the reason why the power action was created, I would have to say it would probably most likely be Rey.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Rey is out of hand, and even as a hero player, I don't like Rey. I don't like looking at her. I don't like playing with her. I find her unfair. I know her die sucks, and everyone tries to use it as some kind of justification, but she's a little outside the box. She's a little over the power curve. Not crazy. She's not FN, obviously, but I find Dex with her pretty boring.
I was going to say, while Rey herself is good, she is a lot more balanced than, like, your FN. And heroes do not have a lot going for them. I mean, they have Rey and Maz, and people are crying out for them to be errata. But if you errata them, what do heroes have left?
That's a problem with a bigger answer than I think we can even talk about at this point, because it's not one or two characters that are, you know, those one or two characters are keeping hero holding on, but doesn't that illustrate a bigger design issue with the game in general? I mean, I know that, you know, we have one question about Kylo and FN sort of looking at, you know, dominating things. And the reality is, it's not just that. It's just villains in general. Villains get way too good cards. And heroes kind of get the stuff that they do get. Everyone's like, please don't nerf it right away. Don't errata it, because what else is heroes going to have? And I think we're always having that conversation. And after you talk enough about that, you're like, why are we still having this conversation, right?
I think it is a problem that will take time to fix. I don't think it is something that we can fix overnight. It will be something that will take time as the game is developed. Like, it will be a problem that if we address it right now, if the designers are like, okay, this is a problem, we need to address it, we won't see the result of it till like 6 to 9 months from now.
But don't you feel like that's too far away for like the average player?
It is, but besides doing a bunch of erratas and grabbing a bunch of things to make balance, there is nothing that can be done. It has to be a natural progression. I mean, if you played any other CGGs, balance usually happens over time.
Yeah. Yeah, very long timeline. But even that, you know, everybody gets things wrong every now and then, you know, and I see FFG is, you know, they're not like super veterans like Wizards of the Coast in this area. So I think we give them some, you know, we give them a bit of a longer leash in terms of things are kind of broken. We need them to fix, you know, we just hope that they're hearing us, right? That they listen to episodes and shows like this and they're hearing that, you know, it's not just the competitive players who are whining about it. We're actually trying to have like a logical discourse about, hey, you know what? I think villains' power level is generally higher on average than most characters. Heroes only function on shenanigans, and when you fix those things, you stifle hero even more, and that just puts villains even higher up the ladder. So maybe you guys need to reassess in general how you design heroes and what actually works and what doesn't, and get maybe better playtesters or more playtesters or something, because the problem is systematic at this point. It's not us. We don't print the cards. We just play the game.
I think the answer, if I had to say this is the answer right now, is to bring villains down while developing heroes, bringing them up until they even out development. Like, I think hitting FN is a great thing and leaving Rey mods as is until needed to try to close that gap a little bit.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, there's always going to be the best decks and good decks and whatever. It's just, if you nerf something like FN, then Kylo 2 is still around and Thrawn's still around and Unkar's still around. And how do you level the playing field when there's more than one problem? You know, if there's one problem, you stamp it out, no problem. But it's just that there's a whole lot of villains above the power curve compared to heroes. And that's overall the issue, I think.
That's true. And I think Obi-Wan is a step in that direction of closing the gap.
Yeah, because you know what they're starting to realize, I think? Activated abilities are really good. And I know that they should have had this conversation a long time ago with themselves. They're just starting to see it now, that they're looking at either passives or activated abilities, because we don't want an action ability on our hero necessarily. Like Leia's action ability, reroll, you know, remove her die or whatever to reroll two dice. It's like, no one wants that. No one wants that at all, you know? But Night Sister is really good, right? So it's like they have to find out what interactions work well with the game and which don't. And something like activating a character or getting a shield is a guarantee. That's why this new Obi-Wan is going to be good, as well as the fact that he's in Blue Hero. Like, Thrawn, activate, name a number and pluck a card, like activated ability. It just works. There's no setup. There's no convoluted thing you need to do. It just works. And that's very strong in Destiny.
That is something that is really common in CGGs, especially when they start out. Is if you look at the first set of like Magic, Pokemon, Yu-Gi-Oh, the first couple of sets are a lot of imbalance. There's a lot of imbalance in them and there's a lot of brokenness. And I think Destiny is no different. And as the game gets developed, the development team knows and recognizes what is good, what is not, what works, what not, and makes changes accordingly. And Power Action is, I think, a prime example of that.
Yeah. It's a step in the right direction.
But moving on to indirect damage, what do you think of indirect damage?
This is a super interesting concept, and I've heard a lot of like naysaying about it. already on the Facebook groups, and I think that's really downplaying its value quite a bit, because you need to look at something like indirect damage as, over the course of the game, how good is it? And actually, over the course of a game, as characters start to die on the other side of the field, it actually increases in value quite a bit. Like, it's more efficient in some cases. You know, splitting damage between two characters is more efficient than splitting the same amount of damage between three, right? And so I think we need to look at these cards with a bit more of an open mind, because I think FFG has an idea here, and we're certainly going to see if it's going to work or not. We'll know by like February or March of next year, probably. But right now, on paper, I think it has a lot of potential. What about you?
When I look at it, I think about how it is thematically. And I think thematically, it makes sense to have uncontrollable damage. And I think the Stormtrooper is the best capulation of indirect damage because, you know, Stormtroopers are known to really not hit their mark.
Yep, that's true. Yeah, this is interesting. I mean, I don't know that I like the term indirect damage. I think they could have called it like bombardment or something like that. It would have been, or scatter damage would have been really interesting. But yeah, you're right. I think it is super thematic. I like it a lot. Definitely the Stormtrooper stuff and the Resistance Bomber having that on its die too is just kind of like, hey, we're just launching a bunch of damage down here. Hope it hits stuff that we care about.
I think it is also a good thing to try to increase the damage output and balance it. 3 for 3/3/6 cost 2 would be broken if it was melee or range, but it being indirect and your opponent deciding where it goes makes it a little bit more balanced.
Yes, absolutely. And there's a couple of things going on with that card in particular that are worth highlighting too. Like, you know, it has that 6 damage side on the die for 2 resources. And this is a 3 cost vehicle we're talking about that can potentially do 6 indirect damage or just 6 damage if there's one character left for $2. And that's a big deal. Like, that is a really big deal. I know you can only use the die 3 times before it dies. I mean, that's one thing, whatever, but you can also, I think you can shield generator with it, right? If a card effect would cause your support to be discarded, it's not, or something like that. I think that might work like kind of like an ammo belt for this card.
I have to look at it. I think it's when your opponent would destroy it.
Yeah, I have to take a look at the wording on that too. I'm not quite sure. But the fact is, there's only one other card that even has a 6 damage side, and that's the Sonic Cannon. And that costs 5 to play and 3 to resolve, other than the character thing. So that's 3 more resources input. So this thing is faster on the table than a lot of other things. And if that's what direct damage is going to do, then that's really interesting. Because I think there's more potential for games to be more thought-provoking, for your opponent to decide where this damage is going to go. Does it eat shields? Do I put it on this thing? Whatever. So I like the idea. I think it's a cool concept.
I think Poe and Hare love this card.
Yes, they do. And I think characters like Bossk and cards like Relentless Pursuit, things like that, are also kind of interesting. You know, also maybe even Bazine, because she's looking at, well, if you don't have damage, I do 3 instead of 1. That's cool. Stuff interaction with Captain Phasma and her increased damage on the special, like giving your opponent some additional thought to this damage application thing is putting the ball in their court a little bit. And that may seem bad for the player resolving the damage, but maybe it's ultimately good for the game.
I think it is good for the game because it adds another layer to the game. It adds more layer to both the player who's playing the card as well as the player who is taking the card.
Yeah, there's more interaction in the game when you're talking about two players making decisions rather than just one. That's what Destiny's supposed to be about, right? It's supposed to be this back and forth. That's what I was told anyway.
So this card, after you resolve it, you put 1 damage on it. I wonder if there will be a card that allows you to move damage between non-characters.
Oh man, that would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Imagine if you had a battlefield claim. Move 1 of your damage counters from one of your characters to a non-character card.
Yeah, something like a main plaza for stuff like this would be cool, I think. I'm also still waiting for cards that recharge backup muscle or air superiority, but I can hold my breath.
That's what I'm thinking. If you had a battlefield like that, you could take 1 damage off your character and move it to backup muscle.
I would love that. That would be super cool.
It would be a little bit slow, but it would be a way to manipulate the board, I think.
Yeah. Board manipulation's good.
So moving on to the, I guess I would call it the feature of this set, plot cards. What do you think of the plot cards?
Oh, I love these ideas. This, like, for months people have talked about, well, this thing is 28 points and I feel like I should get something for that, you know, extra shields or extra resources or something. And And I kind of agree. Like, there's sometimes you can't fit a character point total up to 30, and that's just because of the way that they're costed. That's nothing to do with the player. But being able to fill that 30 points is, to me, should have been something that they thought about a while back. And I'm glad that they were thinking about it as early as Spirit of Rebellion. You know, what you're saying about, you know, the timing of the set being designed is accurate, which I think it is. This is exactly what the game needs. It's also super thematic, right? We got plots going and stuff like that. So I think, you know, there being like hero-specific plots and villain-specific plots and neutral plots will be really great. You know, it's another thing to think about when you're deck constructing. You know, we talk about battlefields and choosing those and character pairings and choosing those and card decks. This is another deck tech thing that competitive players are going to love. They're going to eat it up. I just hope that there's a lot of variety, you know, at the one cost, the two cost, and the three cost, and that there isn't a plot that just kind of like stands out as this is the best plot. If you need 2 points, that you're going to do this one. And that's kind of it. You know, I want to see a variety. I want to see choice.
I agree. It adds so much more to the game. Again, adding another layer to the game when it comes to deck construction. Like, for example, I can run Ray Poe and use that combination, or I can run Poe Mod, and then I have one free slot. So I'm giving up some sort of, you know, power to try to get access to something. And I think it makes more character pairings more viable because of the difference in point cost.
Yeah, I'm wondering, because what I think about is, what's the impact of this? Like, am I really going to think about only character pairings, or am I going to consider character pairings and plot pairings and how I want to construct my deck? And is 1 point less in a character worth bringing a plot into my deck tech? Is that going to be a big deal, or is that just going to be like, I threw it in because I had an extra point, so I'm going to play espionage, you know? Or am I building a mill deck where I'm like actually making them start with 29 cards is a really good thing? So I don't know.
I think it will be interesting to see how the construction of decks will change. It all depends on what your strategy is going for. If you want to play a thematic deck with Leia and Han, you are going to look at that from a character pairing point of view instead of a strategy. Where if you're looking at a mill, you're like, okay, if I do espionage, what can I do with 29 points? It is definitely interesting to see this new mechanic. I think it was expected. I know that I speculated about it. I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah. I mean, I was a little shocked, but I think the filling in the gap here is super awesome. I'm like, man, plots, I love it. I love this idea.
I really like the design of the cards too. Like, you have a full picture on top, and then on the bottom you have like the text box, the name, and all the card details.
Yeah, it's definitely a good design. I like it a lot. Plots. This is the future of Star Wars Destiny.
We talked about legacies for a little bit. I would actually like to address a couple of comments left for us on the Facebook page. Joe asks, are we seeing the beginning of the end of some original Awakenings characters due to them being reprinted, quote unquote, in the next set with different abilities?
The short answer is no, I don't think so. I think we're seeing alternatives, you know, like the new Darth Vader in Spirit of Rebellion didn't replace the old Darth Vader. The new Luke is, I think, a bit more playable as far as, I hesitate to say competitive, but definitely I think he's more fun and casual, because old Luke definitely is not competitive, and that's a problem. I think old Han is still playable, and new Han, maybe not so much. I mean, it's going to depend on his point cost, but there's a whole new set that's coming alongside these cards. You know, we can't look at them just in a vacuum and say, okay, he's 11-14. How does he work with what we got now? Like, well, we can think about that and have that conversation, but there's also going to be another 174 cards, right? So, potentially, anyway. And plots. And how are all those things going to interact? Like, the new Han Solo, the new Luke Skywalker, they're going to exist in a different world of Star Wars Destiny than we're currently living in. There's more elements, there's more mechanics, there's more cards. So, I don't know. Try not to jump to too many conclusions about, because a card is reprinted using an old character, that makes the old ones not usable or something like that. No, all these cards are still legal until we hear about a set rotation. So, just enjoy the game.
I agree. I don't think that they will replace the old ones because they do different stuff. They have different focuses. Like, Kylo 1 and Kylo 2 are both like aggressive type characters, but they approach it differently and they have different points. And depending on your deck strategy and character pairings, depends on which Kylo you will use. And I think that will be true with, like, Luke and Han. I think that the Awakening versions of Luke and Han are better than these two. But you're comparing two different types of cards, basically, because they're approaching the setup a lot differently.
Yeah, these are, like, support character costs, whereas the other guys are, like, we're definitely the big meanie in your deck kind of stuff.
Exactly, and it's kind of nice to have key characters to have two versions, a beat stick and a support role.
Yeah. I think this is really, really, really neat. Don't count these guys out. Like, Luke Skywalker, that's actually an okay die. At 1114, it's got three damage sides, a shield, and a resource. And can increase his damage for $2. Like, and he's got 11 HP. That's actually a good card. Like, again, in the vacuum of today, right? He's a good card. Han Solo, maybe not as much, but that Luke Skywalker looks pretty good. Force misdirection plays, don't forget about those. They're big blowout plays. He can do that. He pairs with Chirrut. He might be good.
I don't know if I'm really sold on Luke Skywalker. I think I'm more sold on Han Solo.
Yeah. Oh, I'd love to hear this.
Well, after you activate this character, you may reroll a die. Basically, Jabba, and you see how good Jabba is. And if you include him at 11, you can activate and reroll Disrupt. I don't know, I just see more potential with Han Solo than I see Luke Skywalker. Just based on that activation, because we see how Jabba is.
Yeah, that's a point, actually. I hadn't considered that. Plus, you know, fast hands is still a thing for yellow. That's a good point. I didn't actually think about that. I didn't even look at his activated ability. Shame on me. And here I am talking about how activated abilities are so good, right? And I didn't even look at this one. But yeah, rerolling a die for free, that's a good thing. I like that a lot.
I think once we get more cards, I think we will know for sure. But if I had to put money, I would put money on Han Solo being the better card. That doesn't mean that he will see more play. It's just how I look at him.
Yeah, well, he makes money still, and that's always the thing we want to do, right? We want to make money.
And when it comes to Luke Skywalker Force Misdirection, I still think Kanan is the better option for that combo. Because you got the focus on Kanan, and you can focus it to a gun, then activate Force Misdirection out of nowhere. Where with Luke Skywalker range damage, yes, he has access to two range sides, but range is more countable than melee. And you're leaving your dice out on the field with Kanan, you can just do it out of nowhere. Spending two resources to resolve one die, increasing it by two, I think it's a little meh, because natural talent, pay one to increase a die by one, hardly sees any play. That one-for-one exchange, I don't think is viable. You know what I'm saying? I think one-for-two is the best way you want to spend your resources.
Yeah, one-for-two is definitely the best way you want to spend. Two-for-two... That's a little rough. But it's character upgrade dice. could be anything.
If it was spend two to increase it by three, I think it would be way awesome.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that would be super crazy.
But, you know, who knows what they have in mind for developing this game. So, Chain asks if the preview of the next set has anything to do with Lucas leaving.
No.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. I think this was in the pipeline. It was already set on the schedule, and it was just coincidence.
Yeah, it was total coincidence. I mean, SOR came out around the time of the Star Wars Celebration, and we heard about Empire at War right there, like a week or two after SOR, right? So this is just par for the course. This is what FFG does. They're like, hey, here's a new set of cards. Also, by the way, in 4 months, you're going to get more cards. And people are like, oh, my wallet hurts so bad. Like... what am I supposed to do? I'm going to want all these cards too. So no, it has nothing to do with Lucas leaving. You know, this is them doing what they do and hyping their game. And they're going to tell you about stuff because they want to keep you interested. Thinking about now, but also thinking about tomorrow and what's coming then.
I think if anything, it has to do with the timing of the FHQ, because they want to get that power action out there through a official announcement instead of a FHQ.
Yes, I 100% agree. I think that they definitely want you to know a little bit about it before they slam it into a rule book for you.
I personally wonder if this will be the last set that Lucas had a hand in, or the second to last set that he had a hand in.
Yeah, that's a good question, right? Because on the chance cube, he said just that. He's like, we're looking at the next set or two, I think is what he said. And so, yeah, this one's definitely his. Legacy's definitely got his name all over it. But yeah, the next one, is that going to be, you know, just Jeremy working on it, or Jeremy and his team? curious to see. Either way, the influence and the cards that we're seeing on this set right here are definitely, it's not just Lucas. This is also Jeremy really having, I think, a hand in looking at these cards, or whoever else was whispering in Lucas's ear about, we need to do things a little differently here. And, you know, activating to draw a card is not powerful enough. Like Luke, we need something different. We need something better.
Before we conclude this episode, Elle would like us to talk about Kylo FN dominating everything.
Oh, man, Al, I wish I had a better answer for you. FN is still strong. His ability has no cap. You just keep playing weapons and keep rolling dice. And Kylo is just, he's great in a meta where people are playing monocolor and two-color decks. Right now, there isn't a whole lot of competitive rainbow stuff outside of Rainbow Nines. And even then, there isn't exactly an even spread of cards, I don't think, in that particular, but whatever. He's good because he's guaranteeing damage, right? These activated abilities like on Thrawn, on Unkar, which isn't guaranteed that you're going to get resources, but it's guaranteed you're going to discard a card. And on Kylo, they're saying there's a good chance, there's a pretty high chance, if you're a good guesser, you're going to get a card. And those kinds of choices that they're giving you with things like FN and things like Thrawn are rewarding players who know the game really well. And that's why these characters are so strong, because they're not being played by your casual players very well. They're being played by your highest level players very, very well. And they're showing you and exploiting how good these abilities are.
I am not a huge fan of the deck just because I'm not a huge fan of FN. But I can see why and how it is dominating. I think it falls underneath the same category as your Jango Vias and your Pull Mods. It is the deck that runs away with the meta in the beginning. I don't think that it will be the deck 3 months from now, but who knows what the meta will develop into.
Yeah, I wish I knew that so that I could start building that deck and be famous and on the internet, but no, I really don't care. But it is a shame. I think, you know, again, the real issue here is that if it's not Kylo FN, it's Cad Phasma or Phasma in general. The new Phasma is amazing. Running away with the meta right now. I mean, we saw Polish Nationals, we have Aussie Nationals just happen, and where is Hero even being represented in here? So taking a look at what these cards and what they do is going to give you an insight into why these cards are good, why villains are good, and heroes don't get anything near this, anywhere close to these kinds of things, and that's why they're not competitive. It's just villains all day long, and that's the game we play.
I think no matter what happens to FN, Kylo is going to be around for a while. I think people are just going to replace FN with Phasma.
Yeah, I think so, because they already do it in the Darth Vader Phasma deck, right? The baby Vader one. So she's just freaking good. That's the answer. She's just really good. She's too cheap. She fits in too many places. And Hero, again, doesn't have anything like that. So you're not going to hear about what the opposite of that is. You know, there is no Hero version of Kylo FN. This just doesn't exist. There wasn't a Hero version of Rainbow FN. There wasn't a villain version of Poe Maz either. But maybe that's coming. Who knows? Relby, Salvo, things are there.
Well, it is time to wrap up. I would like to thank you for joining me for this episode and talking Destiny. It was so much fun.
Oh, thank you for having me. I was very excited to come here and do this with you. I'm a fan of you. So I'm super glad that you had me on here.
Before we let you go, if people want to contact you, how can they contact you?
Okay, so I am all over Facebook. You can find me on Facebook at RebelGraySWD, on Twitter also at RebelGraySWD, and also on YouTube as RebelGraySWD. You can just search in RebelGray, you'll find me. I do YouTube content. Try to do 2 videos a week, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, Friday, something like that, where, again, I focus on tactical analysis, card discussion, beginner, intermediate discussion, some advanced play as well. And I, you know, come on to shows like this to talk about that kind of stuff all day long because I like it. I love it.
That concludes this episode of I Rebel. Thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you all next time.
This has been I Rebel, a Star Wars Destiny podcast. I have been your host, Jedi Geek Girl. If you would like to contact me, please send me an email at irebeldestiny@gmail.com. And as always, may the Force be with you. We'll be right back. I Rebel is an independent podcast, not associated with Lucasfilm, Disney, Fantasy Flight Games, or any other organization. All copyrights for Star Wars, Star Wars Destiny, and all other properties belong to the proper copyright holders.